Hi, Simon Hill here. Enjoy our podcast? If you'd like to help us keep delivering the sort of quality football chat you want, then you can show your support by making a donation. Big or small, however much you can afford, we appreciate all your help, and every cent will be ploughed back into improving production. Thanks in advance from all of us at Shim, Spider, and so much more.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Corner kick. Celtic couldn't handle Wood on the set piece. It's a brilliant header. And Cahill goes to spectacular. What about that? What about that? Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup. He's scored.
You're with Shim, Spider, and so much more. Take it away, fellas.
Yes, hello again, and welcome to episode 45 of Shim Spider and so much more. So a fair bit happening, a new TV deal, Ange Postecoglou linked with Celtic, a UEFA Champions League final to dissect. And our special guest is ex-Netherlands World Cup defender Q Jalens, all in the company of our two golden boys, Željko Kalats and Craig Moore. How are you, boys?
Very well, thank you. How are you, boys?
Yeah, well, very well.
I've been better, obviously, after the Champions League final, but
we'd leave that until a little bit later in the segment, Simon.
Yes. Euros coming up, of course, lads. Who's your tip to win the trophy?
I had a little smoky Belgium, but now with De Bruyne out, that's a big tilt in the armour. Yeah. I don't know. It's going to be very difficult. Some very, very good teams.
So you're sitting on the fence, are you, Spider?
Yeah. Well, now that De Bruyne is out, I can't split them, Simon. To be honest, I think England's a chance. I really do. Mate, France's squad is scary. How can you ever say no to the Germans? I think Italy's got a revitalized squad. Belgium, top team. Holland, top team. Like, seriously, you pick it.
So you've named half the tournament.
But Spides, who's your dark horse? So dark horse, right? So I totally agree with you. Nobody's talking about the Italians. Nobody's talking about Croatia. I agree with you. I think that England have got an unbelievable opportunity to be successful in the Euros. My only concern, Spider, and you'll be able to maybe talk about a little bit more, is goalkeeper scenario.
Not a fan of Jordan Pickford, Maury?
Nah, I think he's got too many mistakes in his locker, Simon, to win to make the tournament.
Oh, what about the Scots, Maury? How are they going to go?
Mate, they'll play with loads of heart, passion. Their first game against Czech Republic, Simon, if they can get a victory there and get 3 points, it would give them a really good opportunity because you never know what's going to happen between England and Croatia in that first matchup. But your tournament situation, Spider, you know what it's like, mate. You must take something from your first game.
Yeah. Okay, we'll do a more in-depth preview of the Euros as we get closer to it, but let's get stuck into it then in Hard Talk.
Hard Talk.
Hard Talk is brought to you by Streamgate, one of Australia's first live streaming companies operating since 2008. They focus on virtual and hybrid events, broadcasting to unlimited online audiences worldwide by either a secure private stream page or publicly on social media. Live streaming allows social online engagement as viewers are able to communicate back to the presenters in real time while social distancing. So should you require a small personal event or business level webcast, then please go to streamgate.com.au or you can find them on Instagram. Well, boys, last week we were still wondering what was going to happen with the TV deal with the A-League and W League. 24 hours later, we knew it was finally signed. A five-year deal with Channel 10 and Paramount Plus, the streaming service. $200 million, the quoted figure. Free-to-air coverage with the rest on the streaming service. What do you make of it all? Is it a good deal for the game? Spider, you can lead us off.
And I think it's brilliant. I was really excited to hear all the great news and the chat on Twitter. And look, it's exciting times because the game now has a broadcaster for the next 5 years. We can really set things in place now for the game to grow immensely. Free-to-air matches, fantastic again. And I really think it's going to be a fantastic journey now for Australian football.
Maury.
Yep, I totally agree, Spides. I mean, I've spoken to Spider offline, you know, speaking to Kevin Musk, like, you know, people that understand Australian football, good mates, and the feeling with the people that I have respect for is this is an amazing platform for Australian football now to really build. And there's some security there, Simon, but now we have a real opportunity to take the game forward. I mean, it's a fantastic deal in terms of you know, the initial investment, the $200 million contra opportunity for more investment in terms of really driving the game forward. So I think it's amazing. Great opportunity. Coaches, clubs, players, certainty. That's what we've all been sort of like looking for over the last 3, 6 months, 9 months, however long we've been waiting. But I think everyone will be delighted with the outcome.
I suppose the one question mark, certainly from the consumer's point of view, is that football is now going to be split across the many different platforms with the Premier League on Optus and the Champions League potentially going to 9 Stan, the A-League, W League on 10 and Paramount Plus. The national team rights are also up for grabs at the moment. They're going to be announced pretty shortly, as we're led to believe. Yeah. It would be better if they were on the same platform as the A-League and W League, wouldn't it?
Well, it would be even better if it's on Channel 10, the first station, free-to-air, broadcast all the Socceroo matches. That would be the best thing.
And Matildas, yeah.
And Matildas. All national team matches on free-to-air, which would be ideal. And you know what? We might get that.
Yeah. And it makes sense in regards to you talking about national team stuff. You don't want to confuse the punters, do you? You want to try and get...
Or bankrupt them.
Well, all bankrupt them. But in terms of you want to make it nice and clear from in terms of the A League, in terms of the W League, in terms of the national team. It would be great if that was all on one platform.
Okay, we'll see what happens with that. A couple of other talking points before we get on to the weekend's A League action. Apparently, there is a meeting on the 18th of June that's been publicised to discuss the national second division. There is potential for a pilot tournament in 2022. They're still looking at 2023 as a start date. I mean, we've spoken often on this podcast about the need for a national second division. But again, it looks like the wheels are slowly starting to turn and that we might actually get an answer after all this endless debate, Spider.
Yeah, well, I think they're on the right track. Like, I mean, a pilot season to set it up and get the clubs that can actually participate in the competition is a fantastic thing for the clubs to find their feet. And let's not kid ourselves. It's a big jump from NPL level to a national second division, not a state league level, a national second division. So having a pilot season for these clubs, I think is very beneficial for them all to learn because we can always learn.
And Maury, the good news keeps coming. The Sydney Morning Herald this week reporting that the member federations have agreed to a review of football's management and governance structures. Perhaps the FFA looking to drive, I keep calling them the FFA, Football Australia. They've had so many different names. Maybe looking to streamline the game's administration and save some money into the bargain. I know Football Queensland are trying to drive these reforms by diluting the power of regional zones up there in the Sunshine State.
Yeah, look, Football Queensland may well be the guinea pig for James Johnson and Federation Football Federation Australia. James is very close to Cavallucci, who's the CEO of Football Queensland. Principle 7 in the 11 principles is all about the overspend, really, the waste of what, 20 million plus that goes into the administration of the game through the member federations. So for me, this is really pleasing to hear, because you know a lot of families are being charged money that really can't afford, Simon. And we shouldn't be in a position in any kind of sport, but we're talking about now football, and we're passionate about football. We want to keep everybody that we possibly can involved in the game, but for too many years, it's been too expensive to be involved in the game. So this is a great initiative, and hopefully, you know, Football Queensland now, and it needs to go a lot further than that, but it's certainly a step in the right direction.
A good news week. Blimey, rarer than hen's teeth for football in Australia. Let's talk about the A-League, starting with the Melbourne Derby. I guess it's a Melbourne Derby. Western United, just outside Melbourne, but absolutely hammered Spider by Melbourne Victory. Behind closed doors, of course, at Amy Park due to the lockdown in Victoria. A rather limp end to Western United's challenge for the finals. And interesting comments from Mark Rudin afterwards saying that a full reset is required. Do you concur with that? And do you think the fact that they've been on the road all season in so many different places has played a part in their failure to reach the top six this season?
Look, losing the first set 6-1, I thought there were a chance to come back from that. But look, I think all the travel really caught up with Western United. They look really flat to me, and they've looked flat. Maury, we've spoken about it in the last couple of weeks off air as well, that they just look like a team who's in need of a rest. The travel's got to them. They're not playing with any buzz about them, and it's a bad way for them to finish, considering, mate, it was against Victory, who's been very poor this year. As for the reset, Simon, I actually don't know what Rudes actually means by that, to be honest with you, because the club's only been alive for 2 years. So they should have really been building and continually building. So I should have spoken to Rudes and asked him what he meant by the reset.
Spides, this is a club, in my opinion, and it's only my opinion, mate, it's in free fall. There's some serious issues. There has to be some serious issues behind the scenes. First season, Rude's done an amazing job. I'm not saying he's done a terrible job this season, but it just doesn't seem to be, off the park, behind the scenes. There just seems to be something missing. And the travel, no home ground, being moved about, not being able to really establish a fan base, all these kind of things. I think there'll be change at Western United.
Okay, another big away win for Sydney FC, 4-1 over Adelaide United. The Reds had Jordan Elsie sent off in that game as well. Sydney short of second now after Brisbane failed to win their game as well. The Sky Blues, Spider, they've won four straight now. They've conceded only one. They're starting to score goals. They've got Lafondra back in the fold. Bobo's fit again and scoring. Ominous signs for the rest of the teams in the finals that Sydney could potentially go and do the three-peat?
Well, they can. They got one problem ahead of them, a team called Melbourne City. But we all called it that Sydney would come good. We kept on saying it. They were huffing and puffing all year, weren't they? But come business end, their squad is too strong. And, you know, Lafondra's come in, Bobo's come in. You know, serious firepower, Barbarossa. They're all playing for keeps now, these players.
So, when you look at it, look, you look at it, right? So the two players, you see, you've got Bobo, who's going to be there for the final series. You've got Lafondre, who's come back for the final series. Ninkovic, unbelievable. And then the team that we backed and that we really liked this season, Melbourne City, which have been unbelievable, gone and been the best team all season. But now going into the final series without a Jamie McLaren, mate, how quickly potentially things can change.
And one or two others, of course, as well.
I think Curtis Good's a massive loss. Mm. Yeah, massive loss for Melbourne City. But Sydney FC's always been a good side. They've got the experience, Maury, that come finals time, they're the one team that I would never want to play in a one-off match.
And, of course, Sydney lose a couple of players as well, notably Ryan Grant and Andrew Redmayne, who are off with the Socceroos. So it's going to be very interesting come finals time. Interesting comments from Carl Viet afterwards about referee Daniel Elder saying we needed a bigger referee for this game. He's from South Australia, but he showed he's not very South Australian. I think Carl's missed the point of being a referee. You're not supposed to be for or against either team. Anyway, Wellington 2, Perth Glory 2. Probably the results neither team wanted, given their place just on the fringes of the final. Another massive crowd, Spider, 22,233. Who would have thought that we'd have been saying Wellington Phoenix are the team that are sort of holding up the A-League at the moment in terms of crowds?
But you know what? Their supporters have been starved of football, haven't they?
Yeah.
They've been starved of football. And sometimes it makes you wonder, bloody hell, where are yous every week when they play? Mm. You know, like when they were playing in Wellington. But they were starved. They fair play to them. They turned up. They supported their team. Cracking game of football, both teams. Cracking game of football. Rocket ready, making a vital save at the end that against one of his former clubs, a penalty against De Villa. But you know what? Wellington, I think, the beginning of their season has killed them, but they've played all their games away from home. If they would have played in Wellington this year, they would have definitely made the top six. They still might scrape in.
Yeah. And Spider, did we see the goal of the season?
Oof.
Tim, oh my God. What's
a cracker.
Mate, what a strike.
All I'm going to say, I don't know, Maury, but you know that in New Zealand, it's always windy. There had to be some wind assistance because it went like a rocket.
Mate, a rocket. So the wind must have been behind him because it went like a bullet.
Terrific stuff over in Auckland. The Wanderers got a win against Brisbane, too little too late probably for Carl Robinson's team, Bernie Abini and Bruce Kamau with the goals. Spider, I want to ask you about Daniel Margush. We've spoken about him before. He was outstanding again between the sticks, head of the Oli Roos campaign in Tokyo as well. Could he be on the plane?
He's a fantastic season. I called it early. He's had a fantastic season and he's grown with each match. And that's what happens when you get some backing as a young keeper. That's his first year that he's actually playing. He's 23 years old. So it shows how long you have to wait to get an opportunity and to develop as a player here in Australia. And he's done fantastic. He made a couple of great saves again on the weekend to keep Wanderers in the game, if I can say. But I thought, again, it was another entertaining match.
Mm, sure was. not sure it's going to save Carl Robinson from an awful lot of scrutiny at the end of the season if, as is likely, the Wanderers do not make the top six for the fourth consecutive season. That is simply not good enough for a club of their size and their stature. Maury, the Mariners, another big win over MacArthur. Reaching the finals after three straight wooden spoons, how big an achievement would that be?
It's a huge achievement for the Mariners from where they've come from, as you touched on, the last two or three seasons. And we were highly critical, or I certainly was at the start of the season, in terms of the improvement that needed to be made. But you've got to pay credit where credit's due. And Stajic has done a wonderful job this season. You know, the Mariners have been up there for a large part of the season and got off to a fantastic start. And still, when I look at their starting lineup, I think it's a good team. It's got A-League experience, but it's not a great team. And that's not being disrespectful to the players. So I think that actually goes in more in favour of what Stajic has done for this team. I think they're boxing well above their weight. I really do. Wonderful season.
Yeah. And it would be capped off if they were to finish in the top six. We'll find out, or will be revealed over the next week or so. Spider, last one for you. Of course, the Socceroos have gathered in the UAE ahead of the big World Cup qualifiers. We've spoken about the players that are going to be absent from the pointy end of the A-League campaign, but also absent from this squad, Aaron Moy and Tommy Rogic.
Yeah. Look, I think Aaron Moy's one. I read a comment Arnie said about being with his family, wanted to see, like he'd been away in China, and it's the only time he gets to see his family. And I think at this time and this part of the qualifications, I think Arnie's been a little bit lenient with it because, mate, Corona has been very difficult for everyone. You know, we've seen Mitch Langerak calling it quits because of the situation, and people are fed up everywhere. So I understand Aaron Moy's situation. Tommy Rogic, I heard, had a slight injury, which you would have thought he would have went to see our doctors over there and maybe get it sorted out over there. But yeah, that's a completely different one that I have no idea about. That's the only thing I know about Rogic.
And I don't think Tommy has had an awful lot of game time, has he, of late with Celtic either. Okay, thanks for the moment, guys. I should also mention a terrific day I had on Sunday calling the men's and women's game in the NPL New South Wales. Great new concept football festival, the best in the inner west of Sydney, up here Leichhardt against Sydney Olympic. It was a doubleheader on Sunday. The trophy, inaugural trophy, won by Sydney Olympic, and they had a great crowd there at Lambert Park as well. It was a terrific day. So thanks very much for Arpia for asking me along and asking me to do the calls. It was an awful lot of fun. Let's head overseas. London calling.
London calling.
Go further with the Australian College of Physical Education. With more than 100 years of experience, ACPE's courses are designed to get you career ready. Their bachelor degrees in sports performance and business, health science.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Applied fitness, education and dance can help turn your dream into a career. Find out where ACPE can take you. Apply online today for Semester 1, 2021. At acpe.edu.au. Well, let's kick off, if we absolutely must, with the UEFA Champions League final. Chelsea defeating Manchester City by 1-0. I think I'll give my opinion first before I ask the boys. As a Man City fan, Chelsea, worthy winners, defended brilliantly, superbly set up by Thomas Tuchel. But I think Pep Guardiola got it wrong. How do you leave out Fernandinho and Rodri, at least play one of them, no holding midfielder, switching Gundogan back to a more defensive role, starting Raheem Sterling, who has had a disappointing campaign, to say the least? I think he confused the players. He certainly confused the fans. What about you, boys?
Come on, Big Chops, you go first.
I was going to say, Simon, mate, so tell me what concerned you. But you kind of rattled it off pretty well there. I mean, look, Pep, we've spoken about this. Maybe at times when certainly the Champions League maybe overthinks things. But at the same time, I thought it was a wonderful game. I thought, you know, I know the 1-0, but it was very entertaining. The game for me was an open game of football. Two teams looking to go and attack and score goals. And you're talking about spides probably five or six times where Man City were in positions where they got that ball across that 6-8 yard outside of goal and all that. Mate, 2 yards in front, 2 yards behind, maybe a different situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Chelsea won the game. Fair play, Tuchel. Well done. What an impact he's made. But I don't think Man City played poorly.
No, me either. I actually thought Sterling was very good. I thought he was causing them all sorts of havoc in the first 20, 25 minutes. And, mate, Maury, big matches like that, they all come down to moments, which we speak about all the time. Two very, very good teams. Yeah. And they were moments. Like, even Chelsea's goal. I'm not being funny, right? Chelsea's goal. The left back, what's his name? Zeka from Manchester City.
Zinchenko.
Mate, seriously, that was a schoolboy era. How a player of that quality and that level can get caught out like that. Maury, you're a defender. You should speak about it. But I was, to be fair, it happened to Chelsea in the first half where Sterling got in behind.
Exactly
the same way. And I'm going, mate, how can you not see him? Like, you have to see him as a defender. But moments of matches.
Now, they are moments. They're big moments in matches. And you know, we talk about modern-day football and the proactive kind of coach and that aggressive press and all that sort of stuff. The reality is, for that goal that Man City conceded, they got their press wrong. Yeah?
Yep.
Because, you know, obviously, Mendy skips a line, right?
Yep.
Which is a great lesson for Australia, that you don't have to play out through the back, this right fullback, centre half, skip the lines. All of a sudden, they're in a fantastic position. And get in behind with one flick on, right, and a forward pass spider. I also believe that where they started and that Edison's position, he should have been edge of the 18-yard box starting position. Maybe then there's no final outcome for Havertz to score the goal.
True. But I tell you, that the boy Werner, doesn't he cop a lot of slack? Like, seriously, mate, he would be my starting lineup every day of the week. Because the amount of work and the runs he makes to open up situations, okay, he doesn't take his chances clinically like one of the top strikers, but his work ethic for the team is phenomenal.
Does an awful lot of unseen work off the ball, you're right. One shot on target, though, for Manchester City in the 90 minutes. That sums it up for me, and I think our City fans knew when Kevin De Bruyne went off, horrible injury, broken nose, fractured eye socket, that was probably game over. But I go back to the starting 11 from Pep. I was in the pub on Saturday night with over 100 Man City fans. And when the team sheet came out, that was the talk amongst all the fans. Why is he not starting Fernandinho or Rodri? And why is Raheem Sterling start? If City fans can see it, I don't know why Pep couldn't. Anyway. Congratulations to Chelsea, worthy winners, European champions for the second time in their history. Across Manchester United also had a miserable Europa League final, losing to Villarreal, Maury, on penalties. David De Gea missing a kick and, again, unable to save any of the penalties. Is he done at Old Trafford, do you think?
It's got an uphill battle, hasn't he? I mean, look, I'm going to be honest with you, it was a pretty poor game to watch, the final. The most exciting part probably was a penalty shootout, and also going through virtually two whole teams and the final penalty getting to De Gea. And by the way, the penalties in this shootout were unbelievable.
Outstanding.
Unbelievable. Yeah. De Gea's the only one that wanted to try and maybe produce a little bit of a clever run up in the side foot. But yeah, I mean, look, Man United, I feel you got to give Unai Emery enormous credit, because I thought they were well organised. They frustrated the life out of Man United, scored a really good goal, which I thought was a poor goal, in all fairness, to concede from Man United in terms of the set piece, especially in the position that they conceded it. I thought Lindelof clocked off. His body position was all wrong. Villarreal, to be fair, and Unai Emery's got an incredible record in this particular tournament.
Mm.
I think that was maybe his fourth.
That's
Europa
right.
Europa Cup.
Yep.
Incredible. Man United, look, didn't do enough, and there's also this question marks about, you know, a few things that we've seen during the game, Simon. Excuse me, in terms of the huddle, like pre-penalty shootout, and who's conducting the conversations, and you know. Does Ole Gunnar Solskjaer have the power or the presence to really take this club forward. There's a lot of questions being asked. I mean, but at the same time, they've got to a Europa Cup final. They've come second in the Premier League. That's not good enough for Manchester United.
No, they've got to win trophies. Let's move on to the playoff finals. Brentford's defeating Swansea by 2-0. Ivan Toney again on target. Brentford back in the top flight for the first time since 1947. And in the League One playoff finals, how about the Aussie? Kenny Dougal with a couple of goals for Blackpool to defeat Lincoln, and they are back in the championship. That's a terrific day for him.
Brilliant. Kenny Dougal. Kenny Dougal was a young lad coming through the system at Brisbane in the academy, Simon. He was playing as a six, as a holder midfielder. Great left foot. He's come overseas, worked extremely hard. Probably not played as much as a six, played, you know, left fullback. But I tell you what a great day for him. What a moment to score two goals in a playoff final, to gain promotion from League One to the Championship, to be involved in the Socceroos, I think at the age of 28. Really, really pleased for Kenny and also for Blackpool. Congratulations.
A late bloomer at Bloomfield Road. Maury, we're going to stick with you because I know your phone has been ringing itself to pieces.
It's melting.
Over the last 48 hours at the news that Ange Postecoglou may become the new Celtic manager. What's been the response in Scotland, which from reading from here seems to be a little bit mixed to say the least. And B, do you think it will happen?
I'll go the opposite way. Do I think it will happen? Yes, I think it will happen. And the reason why I say that, Simon, is that I've been here now 7 months. 3 months of my time here has been about Eddie Howe, when's he going to take it? What's happening? Blah, 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 blah. That's not happened. I don't know the reasons why. And then within 24, 48 hours, really, really strong media coverage over Ange Postecoglou to be the front runner for this job. And you're talking about, in terms of betting, 6-5 even money, which is crazy. I don't think that Celtic will get it wrong twice. So for me, that's why I think that Ange Postecoglou is the next Celtic manager. The first part of that question is in terms of what's the reception been like in terms of his name. Look, in the UK, in Europe, they can be a little bit ignorant at times, if I'm being honest, in terms of if you've not coached in Europe and you're coaching elsewhere, there's maybe not the understanding of what you've actually achieved. You know, Ange still holds an Australian record in Australia, 36 match unbeaten run with Brisbane. Won the Asian Cup, AFC Coach of the Year 2015. Goes on and turns a mid-table club in the J-League to championship winners the following season. So he wins trophies, yeah? It's not his problem that people don't understand what he's achieved in the game. And he's, you know, we know Ange. We know Ange very well. His desire to be the very, very best, to be at the top level. So, very, very interesting. But massively strong reports over the last 24, 48 hours, Simon. So I feel as if he'll definitely be the next Celtic manager.
Spider, as Maury says, we know Ange very well. We know what he's capable of. So I think most of us believe that he could do a good job. But how does he deal with a very different style of play, a very different league, very different expectations he would have at Celtic, and all the media and fan pressure that comes with that, do you think?
Well, for me, the first thing is Celtic is a club about winning trophies. So if you go through Ange's history, tick, he wins. He wins everywhere he goes. So, mate, very good choice. Style of football, Celtic want to play a style of football that wins matches. That's Ange. And he believes in what he wants to do. He's got a strong character. And for people that, you know, maybe, you know, we don't respect ourselves, let alone expecting people from other countries to respect us. Now, Ange is a very good, very, very good manager. His problem is he's got an Australian written next to his CV, And that in Europe is straight away, oh, who's this bloke? Well, they didn't know who Arsene Wenger was either. Before he coached in Japan.
That's what I said. That's what I said over here as well. You know, Arsene Wenger, what was it, Nagoya's Grampus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nagoya's Grampus, sorry. You know, and the impact culturally in terms of when he came to England with Arsenal, and what, 22 years later? I mean, I'm not saying that Ange Postecoglou is going to be the next Arsene Wenger, but the profile is very, very similar. You know, like Ange has been hugely successful. Not a lot of people in Europe or in the UK in particular, Simon, know him. But you know what? He's been in the media for the last 2 or 3 days. If they don't know who he is now, that's more their issue. They've not done their job.
Well, the interesting thing, Spider, you say it's you see that Australian passport, and that's a tick against you or a cross against you. They've been calling him Greek in the UK, so I'm not sure that applies because of where he was born. My own personal view on this, I think some in the UK, the Celtic fans in particular, may be missing the point because they don't know a lot about Ange. This is only my opinion, but I think Celtic are not just looking at winning Scottish Premier League titles because they do that regularly anyway, although not this season. I think they're looking at the Champions League and how they can compete on a lower budget. And that means implementing a style and having a manager that can play those top teams at their own game. We've seen that he can do that with the Australian national team, with Yokohama, with Brisbane Roar, Melbourne Victory, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this is going to be fascinating to see how this plays out.
Fascinating story. Let me tell you, though, whoever gets this Celtic job will not be on a limited budget. They will have the opportunity to spend. So interesting. Like I says, I think with the way that it's been reported the last 24, 48 hours and the amount of phone calls that I've had, mate, Talk Sport, the Herald, the Scotsman, mate, you name it, they're all coming. They all want to know about. That tells me that this is very, very close to being done.
How's that going to go down with you if he starts winning trophies as Celtic manager, Maury, as a Rangers player?
I kind of said it's a tough one for me. It's a tough, mate, because Ange is a pioneer for Australian coaches. Yeah. I mean, Spikes, I don't know who the first player was that eventually sort of like gave that reputation for an Australian back in the day, 20, 30 years ago. You know,
Craig Johnston, probably.
Yeah, but you're right. Probably Craig Johnston. We all grew up supporting Craig Johnston. But Ange's got that in his locker. In terms of being that coach that is that pioneer to really set the trend for Australian coaches coming through. We are resilient, Simon. We are resilient, got great character. More importantly, just because we got an Australian passport doesn't mean that we don't know anything about football throughout the world, because we've been based all over the world. We've played in the top leagues in the world.
Yeah, well, I agree, Maury. I hope he gets this job because, mate, seriously, he's ready for it and he's ready to blow their minds because, mate, you know what Ange's got? He's got big kahunas. He's not scared to make a decision at a club like that. And, I think you'll be successful. I really do.
Fingers crossed. Again,
sorry, Simon. The start, and again, we spent a little bit longer on Ange because this is a wonderful story. It's a massive story, right? But the type of football that Ange wants to play, he dominates. He likes to dominate the ball. So, therefore, his teams have a lot of possession. They play a very attacking brand of football. They score a lot of goals. They create a lot of opportunities. Now, understand when you go to Japan, you go to a mid-table team, and all of a sudden you need a little bit of time to become title winners, which is incredible as well, second season. But he's going into, potentially, if he gets a job, into a Celtic squad that they virtually dominate every game of football they play anyway. That's an unbelievable starting point for any coach.
I guess the problem is, if he does lose a couple of games, then given his relative lack of profile in Scotland, they will be after him. Anyway, let's hope he gives those Celtic fans a nice surprise if he gets the job, which seems eminently possible. There's a whole heap of coaches and managers suddenly available in Europe. Zinedine Zidane has left Real Madrid. Mauricio Pochettino, intriguingly, being linked with a return to Spurs. And Antonio Conte has left Inter. And Spider, and we'll finish up with this one in this segment, Andrea Pirlo has gone from Juventus, and they've gone back to the future with Massimiliano Allegri returning to Turin. The old saying is, you should never go back. Will he be a success?
I think so, because I think he's a very good manager. I actually thought when Zidane left, I actually thought he would go there. But, you know, like, it's a what a merry-go-round of top managers. Where are they all going to end up?
Top coaches.
It is incredible, you know. And we're talking the creme de la creme, you know, the biggest clubs around Europe. I think Allegri will be successful, Simon, to answer your question, at Juve, because I think he's a very, very good manager. I thought he might go abroad. But, mate, when Juve comes singing, mate, what do you want to do? It's the biggest club in your own country, and you know what you're going to get. You know you're going to get backing. And they want to be successful in the Champions League. So, yeah, some big decisions and some excited fans for sure all around Europe to see who's going to lead their clubs.
Boy, it's Conte. He just wins things. But what has been the issue? What has been the issue at Inter that obviously he's been successful and straight away he's leaving?
He threatened to leave last year, didn't he? After the Europa League final.
But that was that to do with the new stadium, or what was that to do with?
He's leaving because they're not giving him any money to spend next year so he says, well, if I go into the Champions League with this, what's the point? I can't. And he's not saying that he's got a bad team, but he needs to strengthen. Like, you know, Maury, every manager every year needs to bring in that one or two extra players to make strengthen your squad. And they've said no spending. They're actually cutting the budget. And he said, well, mate, I'm hiding to nothing. I might as well go out on a high.
Interesting that Paris Saint-Germain have said they won't let Pochettino go. I wonder whether Zidane or maybe Conte might end up at Tottenham.
We touched on also Nuno Espirito Santo.
Mm-hmm.
Santo from Wolves, about what his next potential job opportunity might be. I mean, we were talking possibly Spurs, but now with Pochettino being mentioned to that. Palace is a name that has come up for Nuno as well.
There you go.
Is that a step up from Wolves, though? I think you'd be looking for a bigger job with respect to Palace. But anyway, we shall see. Thanks for the moment, boys. Let's head into our final segment, and another big guest awaits us in Footballers' Lives.
Footballers' Lives.
Well, our guest today was born in Rotterdam in 1978 and began his career with local club Sparta before moving on to Willem II in 1999. But it was his move to AZ Alkmaar that was to become career-defining, a seven-year spell, the highlight of which was an Eredivisie title in 2009. He later played for Wisla Krakow in Poland before coming to Australia in 2013 to play for the Newcastle Jets. A couple of years later, he finished his club career with Melbourne City. He played 15 times for his native Netherlands, including at the 2006 World Cup in Germany. And today, he is back in Newcastle, coaching the next generation as part of the Northern New South Wales and Newcastle Jets setup. He is, of course, Q Jalens. Hoe gaat het, Q?
Alles goed. Alles goed. Met jou?
Yeah, that's the extent of my Dutch, unfortunately. but Spiders, I know, is better. But let's kick things off with your early beginnings. You got, obviously, Surinamese heritage. I think your uncle was, or maybe still is, the TD of the Suriname national team. So football was in your blood, is that right?
Oh, you can say that. So he was first the national team coach, and then stepped up to be technical director for the national FA. And he's still very involved in football, but more on the developing part of things. But yeah, you can say football is in my blood. Yeah.
Were you a Sparta fan or Feyenoord fan when you were growing up in Rotterdam?
So let's put it this way. My dad was a hardcore Feyenoord fan. Right. So he took me to the Kuip. So that's where it all started. But then playing wise, when I started to play for Sparta, like Sparta and Feyenoord, they don't mix. So that was Feyenoord done for me. So then obviously, you know, playing at Sparta became my home club. And from there supported Sparta.
Do you remember your debut? I think it was at Groningen in May 1997. I've done my research.
Yeah, you did. Yes, I do remember. I do remember. Because everything went very fast for me, to be honest. So I played like local NPL first grade when I was 15 and made my debut at the end of 17, close to 18. So in a very short time span, like it kicked off for me. So yeah, very, very memorable. So I remember every little step I took.
You mentioned that Sparta-Feyenoord rivalry. Was it difficult to play for Sparta at that time because you were sort of down amongst the bottom teams in the Eredivisie? And Feyenoord, of course, at that point, were winning the title under Bert van Marwijk. Yep. They went on to win the UEFA Cup in 2000.
Yeah. Oh, so because it was, I think because it was the start of my career, like I was like blessed with every game I could play at that level. So at that sense, I didn't really look at the games like, you know, Sparta, Feyenoord. I was just happy to play in a big stadium, full crowd. So that was the focus for me. So, and later on, when I kind of got settled into the game, that's when you kind of start picking teams and focusing on, oh, I'm at the bottom of the table, I'm in the middle of the table, or we're fighting for a championship. But when I started, I was just happy to play every game I could.
Which is a nice segue to your first transfer, which was to Willem II in 1999. I assume you were looking at a club that was higher up in the league at that point. You went to play under the legendary Co Adriaanse. And you played the UEFA Champions League as well that first season, which I'd forgotten that Willem II were ever in the UEFA Champions League.
I think a lot of people did.
That must have been a great experience, though.
Yeah, I was 20 years old back then. And the transfer I made to Willem II was like a last minute. Not a last minute, but I was away with the young national team. So I was in camp and got a phone call from my manager. And he's like, oh, got this club, Willem II, do some research, talk to your dad, call you back in an hour. And I'm literally like 20 years old. I'm like, what's going on? So I called my dad and he's basically like very down to earth. He's like, oh, note all the positives, all the negatives, go from there. So at the end, it was all positive, positive. Champions League, yeah, positive. Higher in the rank, yeah, positive. So a very easy choice to make. But then being on that pitch when you hear the Champions League hymn or the song, like that's what you dream of as a kid. So, and that became a reality back then.
That's so Dutch, isn't it? It's so pragmatic. Mark down all the positives and all the negatives and see what you think at the end of it. How influential was Co Adriaanse in your career? Because I think he also took you to AZ Alkmaar in 2003 as well. So he obviously liked you as a player. Was he the biggest influence on your career, would you say?
One of the biggest, yeah. So especially as a young player under him, he was very, how would you say, very straightforward. So if you played a good game, you played a good game. If it was a bad game, he'd tell you like straight up. And as a young player, having that clarity from a coach, that's very important because I knew where I stood. And if there were things for me to work on, he would just tell you. And then it was up to me how I would react or how I would go about it. And so especially on the mental side of the game, that's where I learned a lot from him.
Of course, the high point of your time at AZ Alkmaar was that championship in 2008, 2009. Was that a surprise that that happened? Obviously, you were under Louis van Gaal at that particular point. Co Adriaanse had moved on. Was that a shock? Because I think only AZ and Twente, who won it the year after, have ever broken the big three stranglehold, certainly in recent living memory.
Yeah. For us as a team, it wasn't really a shock because 2 years prior to that, we lost the championship on the last day. So we went into the last day with, I think, 1 point difference. And we were fighting that last day with PSV and Ajax. And so as a team, we were up there already, But in that the season after, we always used to lose the big games. But in that season, like everything just came and went our way. So we won the big games. So the lower teams that you should beat, we beat. And that season, everything just came and fell our way. So as a team, it wasn't really a surprise, but maybe for people on the outside, looking at a club like AZ Alkmaar, which isn't the biggest club, for them it might be a surprise, but not for us as a team.
True. At that time, that was also probably your first time, maybe with the Australian youngsters, Brett Holman, James Holland.
Yeah.
So at that stage, you were quite a young player. They were also very young players. What was the feeling then in terms of the Australian player coming over to the environment in Holland?
So let's start with James. James was a young player at the time when I was there. At the time, I was one of the team captains, and James just came into the youth team, and very driven, passionate, put a lot of work in. I only think at that time the biggest challenge for him at that time was that we had a great first team, and everybody was doing well, and everybody was up there. So it kind of blocked his development part, because he couldn't make that next step because of everybody else that was up there already. But I think he learned a great lot at AZ, like mental-wise, playing-wise. I think especially when you're young, when you come to Holland, like development-wise, the way you think about the game can help you progress. And Brett the same. Great quality for us in the team. We used to call him, how can I say it in English?
Say it in Dutch.
The kilometer freighter.
A kilometer freighter. So he could run for fun.
He could run all day, like up and down. So he played on the right wing for us. Yeah. And you just knew. I don't. So for example, for me as a captain, you don't have to worry for Brett. Like, he's gonna work his ass off. He's gonna go up and down. He's gonna get scoring chances. He's gonna get crosses in. So he was a great addition to the team, and very influential in his way of playing as well.
Of course, you also had Joey Didelica, who's sort of Australian. I know he played for Croatia. I'm fascinated to get some insight into what sort of a coach Louis van Gaal was, because the perception is that he's a little bit different. Is that fair?
Well, there are two sides to him. The one side that you see on the telly, and when he has his arguments with the reporters and the newspapers and everything. But then for the team, he is just like your second dad. Like, he would know you inside out. He would know your kid's name, your kid's birthday, your wife's name, wife's birthday. And the way to describe him basically as a coach, I can tell you one story that would just lay it out. So one morning training, one of those days when you're like, oh, I have to get up, go to training. And it was just like one of those days. And my youngest daughter, she was sick, so I didn't sleep at all. So I rocked up, trained, but wasn't really there. So he just pulled me aside, said, mate, what's going on? I said, yeah, didn't really sleep. My daughter's sick. Not feeling the best. And he just took me out of the session. He said, you know what? You go home, take care of the family. So this was Wednesday or Tuesday. And he said, take the time you need. I just want you to be ready for the game on Saturday. And I'm like, okay. So went home, took care of the family, and that Saturday I played the best game. That just describes him as a coach for the team and the way he thinks about his players. So his way of looking at the players, the person behind the player. So if he can fix that, then the player will show up every game.
That's a fascinating insight. And you're right. That's not the the perception of the public, is it?
Yeah.
Do you think he does that sort of deliberately in public to provoke a different perception of who he might be, almost to protect that playing environment?
Yeah. So everything he does is for the team. So he, as a coach, took away a lot of pressure with the way he would act. For example, with the press. So if you notice, he will never take down a player in the press or never talk in a real bad sense about the team. Like, we will hear it the day after. Don't get me wrong. but on the outside, he takes away a lot of pressure. And that was very important for us, especially because we weren't really used to fighting for a championship. So, and with his ability to take away that kind of pressure from us, helped us a great lot progressing as a team.
Describe for us, Q, the celebrations in Alkmaar, which I know is a small town. It's a cheese-making town in the Netherlands, isn't it? Am I right in remembering, this is just off the top of my head, that you went celebrating on a boat down the river or something with the fans lining the banks of the river? Is that right?
Yeah, so it's a bit the same as Amsterdam, where you got the small, like, channels. Yeah. And, yeah, you're exactly right. So, if you got the little channels, like, the whole city was upside down, people on the side, and we were just in the middle on the boat, and we just rocking the boat, like, and the boat just went like this. And yeah, the great experience.
Terrific. Yeah. You also won a championship in Poland. You signed for Wisla Krakow after you left Alkmaar. Which on paper, obviously, you just look at somebody's CV on Wikipedia and you think, that's an interesting move, going to Wisla Krakow, because you weren't that old at that point. Why did you make that move and how was that experience?
So basically, I just wanted different. So growing up in Holland, like, football is a very... So in Holland, it's more of a thinking game. It's a very technical game, tactical. And starting professionally at 17, 18, and I think I was maybe 25, 26 when I went to Wisla. So I had all of that under my belt, and I just wanted something different. And as well, all the baggage I had as a player, I just wanted a challenge to get out of, like, my comfort zone and show that you can perform somewhere else as well. And that challenge came with Wisla.
And Krakow, of course, a beautiful city to live in as well. How's your Polish, Q? You learn a few words? Sounds a very difficult language to me.
So it's the thing that makes it hard is the grammar. So if you misplace one word within a sentence, like, you can be screwed up. Like, you can actually maybe offend somebody or, like, really say bad stuff. But you really just meant to say, hello, how are you?
Yeah. So it's like my English.
Yeah, a bit the same. No, it's so when I would go about, so I could just communicate with people, like, do groceries and everything. But then when I would step that line of, oh, he knows Polish, then I would be lost, like, completely. But then what they appreciate is if you try in Polish, they will try in English. So in the end, like, we got along and you know, sometimes it was hand and feet, but in the end, like, we made it work.
Q, your time there, but you touched on you going to Poland, so you wanted to experience something different because you've experienced everything in Holland and tactically. Yeah, it's hard, eh? Because it's think. It's a game of chess in Holland. How did you feel in terms of Poland? Was the type of football? Were you allowed to express yourself a little bit more? What was the type of football like in Poland?
No, it was very, very different. So I think one of my things that helped me was that I played with a better team. So Krakow was one of the better teams fighting for a championship. But in my playing style, the way I was brought up, that just clashed. So I remember my first game as a center back, got the ball, and I tried to dribble into midfield, and everybody, Q, where you going? What are you doing? But yeah, I was just comfortable going into the midfield because that's what I've been doing all my career. Then, no, mate, you just pass the ball to a midfielder, stay in line, and organize the defense. That's what I want you to do. And in the beginning, I was very confused because I thought, wow, but if I get into midfield, we create an awful load. No, mate, don't worry about that. We want you in the line, organize the defense. That's it. And it was a very, very physical, league. So it didn't really matter who you played against. You could play against number last, but you just have to work your backside off for 94 minutes. And then at the end, you'll see what the score is. So in that regard, that formed me as well. So I was very happy that I took that step because finally I experienced different and had to use another aspect of me as a player rather than, you know, the thinking game and being the chess player that you are. Because sometimes it's just about hard work.
I would imagine that Australia is a little bit different to Poland and the Netherlands as well. That sort of leads us on to your time in the A-League. We had a Twitter question from Blake that sort of sums up the next part of the chat. Had you heard much about the A-League and football in Australia in general before signing for the Jets? And what did you think of the quality in comparison to Europe?
I heard about it through Joey Dido. So he's very involved with his brother at the time. I think it was Melbourne Heart at the time. So I knew some from Joey and Gerald Seaborn, who I know well, told me about it as well, and James. So in that regards, I had some information, didn't really know much about the league. But the how I got to Australia, that was the funny part, because I already had a contract laid out for me with Cambuur, Cambuur Leeuwarden. And I was going to sign on a Wednesday, and Saturday night I got the phone call about Australia, and I'm like, Australia? So I said to my wife, babe, listen, this guy just rang up and he's talking about Australia. And she just went, wow, Australia, are you serious? I always wanted to go there. And we're like, you sure? And she's like, babe, that's it. So talk to my manager. I'm like, mate, listen, whatever happens, it's not going to happen Wednesday. So we just went for like guts and feeling. Like there was no certainty. At the time, because of the salary cap, I was one of the late guys to come in. So normally, like in Europe, if you go to a club, like they take care of like school, house, like whatever you can. You just play football. And so there was no certainty of stuff. So I'm like, babe, are you sure? And she's like, yeah, we just pray for it and we just go. And like, I'm still here. Like the best thing. Yeah.
Mate, she just didn't want to go to Canberra in winter. It is the coldest joint in Holland.
Hey, it is. But to be fair, like after my 3 years in Poland, I played games in minus 20. Like double skins, double gloves. Like whatever cream you could find that might help.
Now, Q, the time at Newcastle was interesting as a player. Let's say that. Talk us through that little era, the Nathan Tinkler era, the player revolt, and your subsequent sacking. Is that the right term? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I still call it a sacking. So let's
give us your take on it.
That season, how can I say, we had Phil Stubbins. So I didn't know anything about Phil before that. But like I said, the way I grew up in football, you analyze everything. You think about everything. If we got the ball, we play this system. what do I do if they play a certain system? What will I bring up against it? What will I do if, like, their center backs got the ball, dribbles into midfield? Like, in Holland, like, the way I grew up, I used to think about everything. And when I had Phil, I would ask, like, okay, like, this is what we're going to do. Like, what's the game plan? What are we going to do if this happens? Oh, mate, I don't think they will. Yeah, okay, but let's...
Maury. You like that one, Maury.
Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, okay, fair enough. But let's say they do. Like, what is our game plan? What, like, is he going to step inside? Is he going to drop in? And I wasn't able to have any kind of technical discussion with him about it. So that was strange for me because that was the first time that I had a coach that wasn't really into the tactical part of things.
Cool. So you've seen very early on in Australia, if you had knowledge and if you had experience, there's a big problem.
Yeah. it's hard as well because you only know what you know. If you just don't know.
Bravo. Yeah.
That's, you know. So, and the same, for example, when I just started, we were doing a passing game, a passing drill, and one of the boys had a missed kick, and everybody was like, unlucky, mate. And I'm like, what? What's unlucky? Mate, get the ball again, do it again, and hit the ball. God, mate, it's only 50 meters. Hit it and hit it well. And they were looking at me like I was a crazy one, like, you know, because for them, oh, yeah, it's unlucky. Yeah, next time we'll try again. But I was thought there's no luck in things. If it's not going the way you want it to go, you work harder or try again. So, but that's a bit of culture, I find, where it's really a safe environment. Everybody's good mates. And I was grow up like, you know, it's business. If it's you and me fighting for a position and it's a 50-50, you make it an 80-20. Yeah. Like, we can drink a coffee after, but, you know, it's not always good mates. Like, I remember in Holland, every Wednesday or Thursday, when you do the small-sided games, you rock up with your shin pads, with your studs, and we go. Like, there's no, like, sorry, mate. You know, there's in that sense, it was very, like, friendly. I remember my first week, like, literally the whole team, everybody asked me, mate, here's my number. If you need something, just... you know, give me boss, ask me anything. And I just went home. I'm like, babe, I don't know what's going on with these boys. But something is going on.
It's funny you say that, Q, yeah, because Spider, you would have had your type of experience. My experience when I went the other way. So I've gone from Australia to Europe, mate, and everyone was kicking the shit out of you. Yeah, because you're a competitor.
Yeah, yeah.
Mate, when I got to Holland, mate, let me tell you, the keepers were not happy that a foreign keeper was coming to Holland. They weren't happy at all because, mate, it was competition.
Yeah.
It was competition. But like you said there, Q, like when I was at Roda, man, we had the best dressing room ever. I swear to God. One of my best mates was Suriname as well, Helio Fred. Oh, do you? And, you don't know. Mate, could you imagine the two of us? We're like 6'6", 6'7", the two of us. One's black, one's white. They used to call us the Sheridans wherever we went. Mate, it was gold. But at training, mate, you'd kick the living daylights out of each other. But afterwards, mate, you go for a broche filet American and have a coffee, and mate, always good.
Yeah, true.
Q, so do you think that sort of over-friendly environment led to this chaotic ending, which culminated in essentially you losing your job at the Newcastle Jets?
Well, like I said, when I started, for example, with the issues I had with Phil, for example, but that then just went down to every player having an issue in maybe not the same, but in something else. So if you look at paper or on paper, the boys we had in the team, we could do a great job with those boys. But in the end, there should be a captain that leads the squad. And if the coach doesn't handle or can't handle the group process, then, you know, all is lost in that sense. So it wasn't just me. The reason why I lost my job is because I was the captain and I just spoke up.
Yeah.
And with me, the other experienced players that knew the game, knew what went wrong, that spoke out, we lost our jobs because of that. And that wasn't anything else. So everybody else that stayed were the young boys that were or happy to play, or they were the last year of the contract. So, you know, for them it was, I either gonna make it or that this might be the last year of playing. In my, for me, like if it would end the day after, I would be happy with what I've done in football. So for me, it wasn't like a life or death situation. And that was also for me the reason to speak out, because I was worried for the younger players who would grow up in an environment like that. And that could damage your whole career if you don't know. So I would know, so I would speak out against things I thought, well, this isn't supposed to go this way.
Q, you're now, of course, the TD of Northern New South Wales, and with the Jets emerging talent as well. The club is in at a low point again in a different way, but yep. has that culture changed at Newcastle?
No, I don't find, not yet. And I hope it will change while I'm here, because I, like I said, I grew up very different in football. If you want to compete and if you want to be the best, there should be a culture where you have to have that desire to be the best. And it can't always be friendly and nice. You know, sometimes you need to be better than what you are. Sometimes you need to be stronger than what you are. Sometimes you need to be faster than what you are, because somebody else might take your spot. And the kids here don't really grow up like that. So the best kid will be the best kid, where either he plays a good game or a bad game. There's no consequence to that. In how I grew up in Holland, there are three or four guys that can do what you do. If you have a bad week of training, that might be your spot.
Yeah. Yeah. Q, got an interesting football question for you. You're a central defender. That was your preference, yeah?
Yeah.
Central defense?
Yeah.
Mate, the Dutch strikers, the ones that I played against, the ones that I worked with, they yeah. like to make the pitch long.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I'm to the listeners, make the pitch long is normally the striker stands behind the central defenders.
Yeah.
This is a difficult situation for a central defender.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So how do they work on the central defenders in terms of that process? Yeah. Because you're always looking over your shoulder. I remember Mikey Moles. I remember
Nistelrooy. Yeah.
This type of striker is very difficult. Quite.
You, first of all, it begins with your concentration level. So there can't be any second in the game where you switch off, because they're smart like that too. Like that second might. Yeah. That like, and they're ruthless like that as well. So it's just, so the way, for example, a number six scans a situation the whole time, that's how a center back would scan and center, like, where's the ball? Where's the striker? Where's the ball? Where's the striker? Call in your defender, because if I need to do this, you need to cover me here. So the communicating part of things. So what I always explain to the kids is, I always explain and tell them it's a thinking game. So the faster you can process information, the higher you will play. Sometimes it's not about your ability. And then I give them an example of, okay, their number six got the ball facing up, and now you're the center back. So within this, how many things do I have to think about? And they go, oh, yeah, well, the striker, where the ball is. And they most of the times give me two or three. And then I'll start to break it down. I said, okay, well, their number six got the balls facing up. I need to know the quality of the six.
Yes.
Is he a good passer? What kind of pass? If he gives a pass, what kind of pass is it? Does it have backspin? Like, does it have some kind of effect on it? Then I need to know where my other defenders is, where my defensive line is. I need to know where my goalkeeper is. I need to know where my 80-yard box is. And I need to know the quality of my striker. And then they give me that look like. And yeah. But that's literally what happens every day. So you just, that's your, it just becomes a habit in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you start to play and think like that when you're 10, 11. So, and then it depends on how you develop yourself, how far you can take that. But it's a thinking game.
It's a fascinating insight into particularly the mentality and how you prepare to play football at the elite level in a country like the Netherlands. I want to finish off, Q, by asking you a little bit about your national career. Then we've got one or two Twitter questions as well.
Yep.
We've mentioned in our promotion for having you on the podcast, of course, that famously at the World Cup in 2006, you weren't playing as a centre-back, you were playing as a right-back, and you marked Leo Messi. And you kept him scoreless as well, which is quite an achievement. How do you prepare for playing against a player like Messi? I assume you knew that you were going to be up against him.
Yeah, so a lot of people ask me that question. So it's one thing to mark Messi, but if you look at the players I played with, Messi wasn't really my concern at that time. Like, I was that confident in my team that they would have to worry about us. That was the mentality. And so let Messi worry about what we bring to the table. So in that sense, my worry wasn't really Messi. My focus was just playing a good game for my team. And the boys that were in my team, like, they gave me that confidence to do a good job.
Did you at least get a kick in once or twice?
Oh, mate, he was dead. I tried. but he's just quality. Like, you know, sometimes it was just sending him to a direction. Like, that's literally sometimes all you can do. Like, you can't even get into a fight or a hassle because he's just that quick and that fast. So it was just teamwork, communicating, closing down the zones, blocking pass lines. So it was just like a team effort.
You mentioned the team that you played with, and again, I'll look through the names: Van der Sar, Kautz, Philip Cocu, Ruud van Nistelrooy, Rafael van der Vaart, Arjen Robben, Robin van Persie, Mark van Bommel, Wesley Sneijder. How on earth did you not win the World Cup in 2006 with all those players? A phenomenal squad.
Well, at that stage of football, it's, you have to have the mojo. You have to have the flow. Like, everybody that's there can play.
Yeah.
It's just about having that mojo of a flow within a tournament. If something is wrong within the team dynamic, or you're not 100% on the day, like, all those little things. And we lost against Ronaldo and Portugal 1-0. But that could be just one off moment that takes you home.
Yeah.
Like, it might win you the game or it might lose you the game. So it's very, at that stage, everybody can beat everybody.
The margins of that level, Q, the margins are so small. I mean, go back, you're talking 2006, Spider. We lose against Italy in the fashion that we lost against Italy, and they go on and win the World Cup. So the margins at the top level are so small.
And
I told you, Maury, that World Cup, like, yeah, all the boys that I played with that were in the Italian team at that time, they said to me the game against Australia was the kick up the backside they needed to go on and win the World Cup, because we scared the living daylights out of them.
Q, I want to ask you, out of all of those players that you played with, maybe it's somebody else, I don't know, who was the best that you ever played with, or against, or both?
Or top three.
Yeah, go on, you can have three.
So the one that wasn't there that you couldn't mention is Clarence Seedorf.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what a player. Oh.
So
what a player.
So playing against him, like, you know, you do your 11v11s and your 4v4s and whatever. Like, they're literally, I don't know how many times I had to face him, but you know when you have, when there's like no chance of you touching the ball, like that's, yeah, that's just literally what happened every time. Like no chance, like his body, the way he moves, like big like this, but agile as, like, I don't know.
What about when he used to shield the ball with his ass? That's the ball, I mean, and he just shield it with his ass. You just bounce off it.
And you just lose sight of the ball. So at that moment, you're gone. and then the next thing you know, he's turn and faces and then gives like a direct from the one side of the pitch to the other side. And you just think, like, man, what am I going to do?
Like, what a player.
Brilliant.
What a player.
Hey, Q, I want to finish off with this one. It is our Twitter question of the week. We could talk for hours, to be honest. Yeah. Just fascinating insights. But this is our Twitter question of the week. $100 Outback Steakhouse voucher going to David P, who says, this is about the World Cup in 2010. You didn't play at this World Cup, of course. Mm. He says, what did you make of Bert van Marwijk's tactics in the World Cup final in 2010? I think that's a good question.
So that was a funny one, because I think that was one of the only times where Holland didn't really play, like, you know, the tactical, technical. That was, for me, that World Cup was about Nigel de Jong giving the fly or high kick onto somebody's chest, and you're like, well, that's not really like the Dutch way of, you know, playing the game. But that is exactly what got us to that final. And so in that sense, I don't mind. Because for me, you need to find a way to win. And if you sometimes have to go out of your way to do that, that's what you need to do. So I completely understand the difference in tactics, because at the end, nobody will remember like who lost.
Yeah.
Everybody will remember who won that game.
And yet, strangely, we do remember who lost, because it was so un-Dutch-like, wasn't it? Anyway, it's a good answer. Spider, do you want to ask your weekly question before we close off?
Yeah, Q, tell us, mate, the best stadium you've played at, and don't say the Coop. And the biggest dungeon you've played at, and don't say the Coop.
The biggest. Well, it might not be because of the stadium, but when I played that World Cup game against Argentina, it was literally half of the stadium was bright orange, and the other half was white and blue.
Yeah.
And Maradona was at that game. Our king and queen at the moment, they were at the game. And I met all three of them. So if I can make a package of the biggest stage, of the biggest moment, that feeling comes with that stadium. Because that was just the full package I had that day.
Which stadium was that? Was that in Germany?
Yeah, it was in Germany.
We only played, it wasn't Allianz.
No, it wasn't Allianz. Where did we play?
I'm trying to find it at the moment. What's you're talking?
All right, then tell us the biggest dungeon.
What's the worst stadium? And I'll find out the best stadium for you whilst you're doing that.
So I'll give you two. So the one in Holland, VVV Venlo. Oh,
yeah, so yeah, that was a dungeon. Yeah.
You literally, your whole schedule, your game day schedule was out of the window, because it took you maybe 50 minutes to get to the pitch. Then you needed to climb stairs for about 5.5 minutes to get to the shed. So that was like, mate, seriously? Like, yeah, that will be number one. And number two, like, I've played some games in Poland where I thought, like minus 20. Not really like the best atmosphere. Like, you know, you play on ice, they spray the line red, give you an orange ball, and just off you go, 90 minutes.
that stadium at the World Cup, by the way, was in Frankfurt.
Yeah,
correct.
Deutsche Bank Park, as it's known now. Yeah. It probably wasn't for the World Cup. Hey, Q, we got to leave you there because we're out of time, but they're absolutely fascinating insights into your playing career and your views on football. We wish you all the very best with Northern New South Wales and with the Emerging Jets program up there in Newcastle. Thank you so much for joining us, mate. Thank you, Val.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thanks, Yonga.
Keep it going. Well done.
Yes, away. Cheers.
That is Q Yullins, and that is us for another week. See you again next Monday for another Shim Spider and so much more. Until then, bye for now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.